Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to the 10th episode of Season 3. I am psyched to be with you, Dr. Elizabeth Kilmer. Dr. Kilmer is a licensed clinical therapist, qualitative researcher, author, and ADHD panel designer and advocate. In this episode, we talk about the challenge of working multiple jobs, the therapeutic value of TTRPGs, D&D and such, research, and so much more. Dr. Kilmer is one of the coolest people I know. This was a great chat. I hope you enjoy it. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Blind Psyche with me, your host, Christopher Leach, aka Chimp195. Episode 10, spooky season is upon us, is nigh. It's autumnal. I'm already wearing a cardigan for this episode, so life is moving in the right direction, generally speaking. I am delighted, enchanted, enthralled to bring you yet another excellent guest. All that remains for me to do is pass it over to you and ask you to introduce yourself, please.
Hello, everybody. My name is Dr. Elizabeth Kilmer. I am a licensed clinical psychologist, and I have a couple of hats. So I am a qualitative researcher over at Take This, which I'm sure you've heard about on this channel before. But Take This was one of the first mental health organizations to serve forming both serving both the gaming community and the gaming industry. I also am a clinical psychologist with SafePoint Behavioral Health, which is a private practice serving geeks and gamers. A lot of our staff and our clients either really love games or work in the games industry, are neurodivergent and somewhere on the LGBTQIA spectrum. So that's me.
We love the Alphabet Mafia, the Rainbow Union, anything that's, you know, generates a collective. Big fans. I feel like I could definitely like remix that introduction of Take This because I've had so many people on the show say it. And yeah, I know what you're all thinking. Gosh, he's got another psychologist on. But the reason that's interesting is because everyone's a little bit different. So that's a few hats, which I love to see. We've known each other for a little while now. But I met PAX East 22, was it? I don't know what year it is now. I feel like I'm slowly getting through pretty much everyone I met at that con being on the podcast. I'm nearly done with that checklist. So thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. I'm very excited. So
glad to be here.
You gave us that sort of overview of what you do. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what you've been working on recently to give us a bit more of a flavor?
Yeah, absolutely. So most recently, a lot of the work that I've been doing has been around community resilience in online gaming communities. So I have been working with Dr. Rachel Cowart over at Take This to better understand the tools that the industry has and the tools that the industry needs to help support more resilient gaming communities, specifically with an emphasis on identifying tools to reduce extremist exploitation in digital gaming spaces. So the like less fancy way of that is digital gaming spaces are great ways to like build communities and connect with people and make friends. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have absolutely like helped stay connected with people who live in other places by playing games. And because games are such an amazing way to build community, they are really, really appealing to people who might want to build communities for problematic reasons, specifically around extremism and extremist ideology. And so we want to help game developers, help the industry, help policymakers create tools and techniques and best practices to kind of resist those bad actors in spaces.
It truly is, not always, because games can do good as well, but it's facilitating those people that like would be that slightly questionable group of characters in the corner of the pub that like, you know, you were probably told to not get involved with, and they would have like these strange secret meetings that you didn't want to go to. Be able to do that in open space.
Yeah, and it's an interesting space because like people want to find community, right? And so if you are somebody who has tried really hard to find community and that hasn't worked in your physical spaces at school or at work or in your community, then seeking out community online is something that is really powerful for people. I'm somebody who has ADHD. That is something that, like, I didn't get a lot of education or have a ton of community on growing up. And some of my best friends in the world, or the people that I've connected with the most, are people that I have met in online spaces over kind of that, both that shared identity and that shared marginalization. And so it makes sense that we would want to seek out and connect with people online. But we also know that there are bad actors who are going to leverage that, who are going to say, like, oh, people don't understand you, or people don't get along. Well, you know, here's the reason. Introduce, you know, conspiracy theory or extremist ideology. It's not your fault, it's other people's. And that can be a way in which people can start to kind of build these communities around these more like toxic or hateful ideologies.
I believe that's what the kids sort of call these days, like red flags. You know, you see these red flags, these kind of danger signs that people might be operating within.
Mm-hmm. I do believe that that is what the youths call them.
I wouldn't know because I am not a youth, but that's a me problem. Let's peel back the next layer there. So this is a piece of research. What is your role within the research? Can you explain that for mm-hmm. us? Because research is multifaceted, yeah. Right?
Research is multifaceted. The thing that I have done, spent the last like 7 or 8 months doing, has specifically been around running focus groups for people who are in the industry and understanding at kind of a broad level. We looked at people from studios of all different sizes who are in different roles. We looked at designers. We looked at people in trust and safety and community moderation roles. We looked at community management roles. We looked at leadership. And we kind of got people in a room together and said, hey, you know, what is your awareness of this problem? What are your awareness of tools? What has worked for you? What hasn't? Where are the gaps in the industry? Those kinds of pieces. And we collected an obscene amount of recordings for that were all then transcribed and analyzed. Had some awesome support with Rachel, as well as we had a doctoral intern, Zainab, who helped us out as well. And we are now working on like kind of reflecting that information back to the industry, as well as developing workshops, through writing a couple of papers that are either accepted or under review right now, as well as thinking about those next steps, presenting at conferences, also developing workshops, continuing to collaborate with members in the industry, being able to work with people who have different like training backgrounds and different work backgrounds, I think is really important for stuff like this, because we're thinking about building up, if I'm building up a resilient community, I want to be doing that with people who have multiple areas of expertise. So a lot of my role is the kind of qualitative research side. So a lot of writing, a lot of reading, a lot of the academic work I swore I would never do, as well as kind of facilitating groups of people, which is something that I really enjoy.
So nerdy question that I'm just interested in. What analysis uh-huh. did you use, if you can tell me?
Yeah. So for the qualitative groups, what we did for that one was we used a thematic analysis. So which mostly means myself and several other people spent a lot of time reading things over and over and over, and then talking about what groups they went in, because these focus groups were kind of semi-structured, which means we had a general understanding of the kinds of questions we wanted to ask, but we didn't ask every group the same exact questions. It would have been really inappropriate for us to go, people said extremism X number of times, or people said that extremism is a big problem versus a little problem X number of times, because not every group was asked the same questions. We also asked follow-up questions. So where that kind of comes out is we have this really rich data set that we were able to kind of organize into general themes. And then from there, we have like little sub themes. And then we're able to talk about things like, what is from our sample, the perception of barriers to engaging in effective, like the effective building of solutions in this area, or what are some of the solutions that people have been employing in their spaces?
That was legitimately one of the best descriptions of like thematic analysis I've heard in a while. Just being like, yeah, we weren't tallying how many times people said things, but doing actual analysis on it. So I'm kind of interested then to explore, because you mentioned academic work that you'd never do. One of the reasons that I like take this, and you know, others on the show I like take this, is that they are actively doing work that serves the industry, right? How was that for you coming in on this project, particularly with a more therapeutic background, maybe?
Oh, this is a great question. So when I was applying to grad schools, I knew that I wanted to do clinical psychology. I was really interested in that. I definitely didn't really understand the difference between clinical and counseling psychology. But most of the people that I was interested in working with were clinical psychologists. So I was like, cool, decision made. And when I was applying to schools, a lot of schools had really were heavily research focused or were heavily practice focused or were heavily teaching focused. And that was something that made the kind of process of applying to schools challenging for me because I am someone who likes to do a lot of different things. And if my day looks the same every day, I will be very sad. And I have this very vivid memory of crying on the floor in my bedroom in Philadelphia while I'm filling out these applications, because you have to create this paper that is supposed to summarize you as a human and what you're going to do. And a lot of these schools wanted you to say, I definitely just want to do academic work, that's all I care about, or I just want to do research and that's all I care about, or I just want to do teaching and that's all I care about. And that's not, I wanted to do all three of them. I cared about all of them. That's part of why I wanted to get a doctorate instead of getting a master's degree. And I was really lucky
Hold
to end up
on,
at a
hold
school.
on, I'm
Go
sorry.
ahead.
Instead of a master's.
Well, I got a master's degree on my way to a doctorate because the most PhD programs in the States will have what's called a pass-through master's as opposed to a terminal master's, which means you get it on your way. Because even if you get a master's degree in clinical psych, it's in then you go into a doctoral program, you mostly have to repeat the coursework for a master's program anyway. So people end up with two master's and doctorate. So I wanted to get a doctorate. That was my end goal, was a doctorate as opposed to my end goal being a master's degree.
Oh, right, okay. I
But I
ask
do have a
because
master's degree.
they're basically like very separate here. Like doctoral programs are very distinctly different to masters.
And they're 3 years instead of 5 to 7.
I mean, that is not necessarily a good thing as someone who is
I know.
falling into year four of their PhD. So, you know. Anyway, sorry. So you kind of when able to be like, I just want to do one thing. You kind of wanted to do them all.
And I was really lucky to end up at a school that had really solid training in clinical work, both therapy and assessment, in research and writing and study design, as well as in teaching and education. And so I taught statistics for undergrads through most of grad school, which I really enjoyed doing. I'm that kind of nerd. I mostly just liked taking a bunch of students who were scared and didn't want to be there and help them become less afraid of math by making jokes about Nick Cage.
I mean, that tracks.
That's what I did. So I enjoyed that. I really enjoyed getting to do research. But I didn't want to be in academia, work for a university kind of space. And I wanted to have a fair amount of flexibility. I didn't want to be stuck in a large organization. I did for a while think that I would have a career in the VA, so working with veterans. And I loved working with veterans. I did a lot of trauma and substance use work. But the VA is a very large bureaucratic organization, and I don't do well with the idea that this is how we've always done it, so we should just keep doing it that way.
I resonate with that on
And
multiple
even if it's
levels.
Yeah, and even if it's inefficient, it's good enough. Like that, my I don't do super great in that space.
Hold on, you're trying to tell me that this comes from a place of like you wanting to do what's really good, progressive, optimized. Like, well, hold on. What are you doing trying
I
to come
like
in?
solving problems. Like solving problems is really fun. I don't like sitting with and noticing problems and not being able to do anything about them. My brain gets really upset about that. So from that program prepared me really well to do a lot. I did my internship, my kind of final residency within the VA, and I loved I loved that internship. I loved the site that I worked at. And then I had the opportunity to jumpstart a training program at a different games focused nonprofit. A lot of the work that I did there was focused around therapeutically applied role-playing games. So I started running D&D therapy groups when I was in graduate school. I did it with adolescents who'd experienced trauma. I then got to do it in the VA with military veterans. A lot of the diagnoses around there were like depression, PTSD, substance use. I loved doing that work. I really, really fell into it. I had the really awesome opportunity to get to work with my spouse on that as well. And then got to kind of spin up and build up a training program focused on teaching therapists and educators and community members about how to use games in their communities to help support change. We talked about therapeutically applied role-playing games was the big piece. And then we also talked about video games. So things like Minecraft. I've also used games like Animal Crossing to help with exposure and rehearsal related to like needle phobia exposure therapy, which is something that's really fun. I got to co-write this book right here that got published this year.
Can you describe for listeners?
Yeah. So this is
Reaches for Book.
Yeah, this is a book. It's called Therapeutic Applied Role-Playing Games, Game Girl Method, and it is like a whole academic manual that I think is pretty nicely written about how to use tabletop games like D&D, Pathfinder, Quest, Tales from the Loop to support growth in clients. It is so many years of work like shoved into one.
Pardon the fact that I am visually impaired, but did you move that book from the shelf to have another copy behind it?
So that's not actually like an actual book stand. It's supposed to like hold up something else. And so if I shove both of them together, then it won't fall over.
Oh, okay. Right. I was just like, yeah. Like, oh no, here's like, I'm ready to ship this one immediately. Like,
no. Yeah, so I got to do that work and then transition over to working at Take This. And so my role at Take This, there's a little bit more, I mean, I did just write a book, but there's a little bit more of the kind of like academic and research side. So my emphasis shifted from doing mostly kind of education focused work with research as a secondary piece to now I'm doing mostly research with education as more of a secondary piece. And then I continue to do clinical work as well. So I do psychological assessments. I do a lot of like adult ADHD and autism assessments, as well as I have a few individual therapy clients.
You just reassigned your skill points. You're already good at all those things. You just reassigned the actual values.
I just get to, I kind of like shift it. So getting to jump into the, like getting to jump in to work with Take This has been an incredible experience. I think I had like enough space from like my dissertation and finishing up grad school by the time I started to take this, that I was like excited to jump in. I've done obviously a ton of work on using games for good and to build communities, but I had less experience around some of the extremism and dark participation in games. And so that has been fun to really kind of catch up on some of that work and understanding in the last 8 months.
So we're seeing this sort of, you know, this timeline, this journey, and I feel like that in my brain at least makes a lot of sense. I can see the kind of progression there. But, you know, as we like to do on this show, we like to go yet another level further and go sort of like, how and why did we get there? I mean, you mentioned therapeutic role-playing games, but I mean, where's your interest in gaming been to sort of be working for a mental health video game charity?
Yeah, I think like I grew up in a family that played a fair amount of games. I got to play Battlezone on the PC probably way earlier than I should have because my dad was really into it. As a family, we would play like Myst and Riven and have like whole notebooks because those are just like very heavy puzzle games. A fair amount of like traditional, you're more like traditionally board games like Monopoly, stuff like that. And a lot of the games, especially the video games I had access to when I was a kid and also were mostly my brother's or my dad's. So I played a lot of Civilization. I played a lot of, Played a lot of Civ 3. I played a lot of Age of Mythology.
Oof.
I played a lot of Age of Mythology. And when I was a teenager and my brother and I didn't get along quite as well as often happens with teenagers, I kind of lost access to a lot of games. Most of my close friends weren't playing a lot of games. The one close friend I was the one close friend I had who played a lot of games, played a lot of Call of Duty, which I didn't really care about. And so I didn't really get back into games until college. And then grad school, I got to play D&D for the first time. And it was this like really lovely overlap of getting to play D&D for the first time and spending like 6 hours every Sunday playing with my friends. Taking a bunch of my like learn how to do therapy classes that were all focused on like building insight and understanding values and like conceptualizing yourself and conceptualizing like yourself as your identities and also not as your identities. And then learning that some people, Adam Davis and Adam Johns up in Seattle, were using tabletop role-playing games to help build social skills. It was this like really lovely kind of like coalition of like, oh, I can like push these two things together. This is super exciting. I don't think that I like it, some of that was really just happenstance. My spouse was a couple of years ahead of me in grad school and was able to start running some of these tabletop groups, and just getting to see the impact that had on clients immediately was really exciting and kind of had me hooked. I also think, similar to the way in which I liked teaching stats to undergrads, because I wanted to take something that they thought like sucked and was uncomfortable and help them feel more empowered around it. I think that the idea of like games, especially with some of this like societal pushback that like games are bad. I was doing a lot of the tabletop work in Texas, and we had people who were concerned that we were like calling the devil when we played D&D. I think it's fun to get to kind of like create a space in which people get to learn stuff about the things that they might have dismissed or they might have otherwise thought were just for kids or were devil worship.
I mean, I like to roll math rocks as much as the next person, 100%. But I'm kind of interested in, like, how, say for a listener that kind of knows what D&D is, it's been hyper popularized like past sort of couple of years. I'd say it's really had a resurgence. But like, what is the value of exploring some of those things, around like other people or things like that?
So D&D at its core is this collaborative storytelling game that has structured rules. It has some like elements of luck. You like roll die to see certain outcomes. And the value of like games broadly in mental health, like one of the core pieces is that it is they are engaging, they are fun, that you want to approach them and engage in them. Most people, if you're like, hey, would you like to play a video game? Might say yes. When you say, hey, would you like to do exposure treatment for trauma? They go, no, that does not sound fun. No, thank you. And so when we can kind of pull in like games with something that might be important to someone, but they feel less comfortable with it, then that's a great way to tie those together. Also, games create this space in which failure is often more normative and feels less risky than the real world. So if I am trying to make friends with somebody, or I'm trying to learn how to engage in healthy conflict, but interpersonal conflict has always felt really scary to me because, when I was growing up, maybe whenever people got in conflict around me, it had really bad consequences for me or for other people. And so if I'm trying to be able to engage in more healthy conflict and more healthy, like challenging conversations, that may feel incredibly scary. It might be really dysregulating. But if I can kind of practice that in this game space where I'm both my character and also not my character, and we can pause at any time and the situations aren't as real, that can be a really nice space for me to practice and feel more comfortable with failure and just feel have like just a little bit more space between like me and the skill that I'm working on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I feel like I follow that. I think again, I'm just indulging my own interests. That's what this podcast is really. But I'm just kind of interested to explore because I remember I picked up D&D a couple of years ago, and like the first character I made was, a half orc rogue that had dark vision and is like, super stealthy and sharpshooter. Because I'm blind and very pale, so it was like almost like the antithesis of myself, like to almost like explore that, like okay, imagine being like a Deadshot kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And that was just through like what would I enjoy playing, and you're the therapist, maybe that was my subconscious desire to explore what having vision would be like. In a world that is still sadly a little bit ableist and discriminatory. See previous episode with Jen Kretschner for more on that. But what's your take on that, like truly being able to explore oneself in this, particularly through character creation, maybe?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love that you brought up that there are absolutely like problems with these game systems in terms of how they handle both like diversity as well as a lot of these systems are built on fantasy themes, and those fantasy themes are built on these like books or stories that were written mostly by white dudes and often by white dudes who had like racist and xenophobic like views and ways of looking at the world. And so it's really important that we kind of be mindful of that as we move forward. There's some really cool there's some really cool like systems that are working to kind of correct that, as well as a lot of the larger companies are thinking about ways in which to more effectively move forward and increase like meaningful conversations around like diversity and inclusion in spaces. I'm not gonna psychoanalyze you on a podcast. But I will say that commonly people will create characters as a way to either explore pieces of themselves or to kind of like move towards or get the experience of getting access to an identity or a skill that they may not have as much of in real life. And so that could be something like when I play a character who is a character who is like really calm and collected and like doesn't get like doesn't have any kind of like emotional reaction, is just like really chill. That is something that is not super me in my daily life, and so it's something where I can kind of get to practice that. I may also People may also play a character that allows them to engage in something that is a part of themselves they may feel more like shame or distrust or like fear around. So I mentioned I have ADHD. A lot of my characters are really impulsive, and they get to be impulsive in ways that create the most fun stories in D&D,
So
but might
chaos.
cause some problems in the real world. And so just getting to kind of explore those parts of ourselves, I think is really powerful. I think that when it comes to thinking about like I'm somebody who deals with chronic pain. My characters are mostly not going to deal with chronic pain. Like I don't want to have to think about the like logistics of my character dealing with chronic pain in a D&D setting for fun, right? Like if that's something that's similar for you around like vision, that may be the same kind of thing. Obviously every person who has a disability is going to like, that's going to show up differently for them. Sometimes if you use a mobility aid in the real world, you may want to get to use a combat wheelchair in a tabletop game and have that be something where like you are actually in a pretty accessible world to wheelchairs. Like that could be awesome. Or you could say like, I don't want to have, I want this to be the 2 hours a day where I don't have to think about a wheelchair. I don't want to have to think about how inaccessible my world is to me on a daily basis. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it's about playing in a world you want to play in, right? I'm kind of interested as well, and this is me plugging because I know my guests, we're friends besides the show, for listeners at home. But obviously, ADHD and tabletop role playing games was quite the popular escapade at the most recent PAX West in Seattle. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
So we have this panel. The title has changed a little bit, but the gist is the same. So it's called Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Dragons. And we've gotten to just collect a bunch of people who play D&D or use D&D therapeutically and all have ADHD and get together and get on a stage for a very chaotic 50 minutes to get to just talk about what we like about playing D&D, what, or like tabletop games broadly, what are the ways in which we feel really excited or included at tables, and ways in which we have shifted or adjusted our own games to make them more accessible to us. So for example, in grad school, I would get together with friends for 5 or 6 hours on a Sunday, and that, like, playing for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours is something that's relatively standard in tabletop spaces and just doesn't work super well for my brain. I was the one who was constantly like getting up to like fix people's snacks or like get water or like pace around the room because I was losing my mind because I had been trying to concentrate for so long. So like things like I tend to max out at about 2 hours. If it's a one shot, I can go a little bit farther, especially if we have breaks. But things like that, things like getting to play characters that are more aligned with you, or getting to lean into some of the play around, like how many notes do you take, or does someone else take notes? What does that look like? So it's a very fun panel. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, huge reception, great audience. I thought it was fun, and I'm turning this into maybe a more informative episode. But with you being someone that I think is really eloquent at speaking about it, can you maybe talk to us a little bit more about just like what ADHD is? Because again, I feel like this is something that we see a lot of on the internet that is maybe misinformed. One of my friends came up with it, but I had to joke that I have ADPHD, which is attention deficit philosophy hyperactivity doctorate. Because trying to do a PhD is a scramble at times. But just because there's a lot of myth that goes on the internet at the moment.
Yeah, I feel like TikTok is both like the best and worst thing to have happened for like general populace education around ADHD. There are some phenomenal, incredible creators who provide really, really good information. I constantly send people to How to ADHD, Jessica McCabe does YouTube as well, some stuff on TikTok, as well as Danny Donovan and Katie Soros. There's some amazing people out there. And there is a lot of stuff that it can be confusing. ADHD is it used to be ADHD in attention deficit disorder, so ADD. It has now been combined under this one umbrella that is called ADHD. It's considered a neurodevelopmental disorder, which means it is something that you have throughout your lifespan, though your symptoms may look different at different stages in your life. Some of that is due to like your own body stuff, and some of that is also due to your environment and the demands on your attention, how well the demands you have on your attention fit the way that your brain works. Typically, individuals with ADHD have challenges with what we call executive functioning. So executive functioning tasks are the things that help you do the things. So they're in charge of a lot of the like project management and initiation stuff in your brain. People with ADHD don't have like a deficit of attention. They struggle to regulate attention. They can struggle with things like prioritizing tasks, starting tasks, switching from one task to another, spending way too long on one task, struggling with like things like time management. So those kinds of pieces. It can also show up in a lot of social spaces. So this could include things like challenges with regulating your volume, impulsivity in communication, which can come off as like interrupting people a lot, or kind of losing track and telling these really roundabout stories. And what we find is that when individuals with ADHD like have a diagnosis and are in kind of supportive environments and have access to the things that they want, they do great. They thrive. Things are really good. Oftentimes, though, ADHD is associated with things like anxiety and depression. Often because people are trying so hard to get their brains to work like everyone else's, and that just isn't effective. So Dr. B, who's also Take This, has a really nice way of thinking about talking about ADHD and autism around like different operating systems. So you've got like your Windows system, which might be your neurotypical individual. You've got your Mac, which is your ADHD, and then you've got Linux, which is your autistic individuals. And those are all solid operating systems, and they're going to do things. They're going to have different strengths and weaknesses. And if you try and use a Mac shortcut on a Windows machine, you're going to be really sad. It's just not going to work. And so thinking about the way in which those kind of brain differences can translate into challenges in social and occupational and educational settings.
Sorry, I realized, like, as you were talking there, and I don't know if anyone's ever told you this, but you have a very nice voice for describing things. I was like, this is just really soothing. I'm just enjoying listening to my own podcast that's happening. So I just kind of really fell into, like, the rhythm of what you were saying there. Anyway, but, like, I've been in a meeting with you and Dr. B, which are both, like, two incredibly great voices. It's a delight. It's a good time. Anywho.
He's got a great voice. He really does.
So I appreciate you sort of illuminating that for us, because I'd say I think there's a lot of misinformation. Maybe it would be interesting to then sort of go on and say, well, okay, well, what do you do when you're not working? If at all you're ever not working, because it sounds like you're doing a lot.
Yeah, that's a great question. I collect hobbies. That's the thing that I do. I actually really want to thank Kate Osborne and Katie Source for that kind of language, because I was always the person who was like, I would try something and I would just like fall into it and really do it for a while, and then I would just abandon it. And I always felt kind of guilty and bad about that. Honestly, that system of like collecting and then abandoning hobbies has helped me build a lot of the skills that has helped me be successful in my working life. But the things that I'm currently doing, I have a dog who needs just so many walks. So I do a lot of walks with my dog. Her name is Badger. She's very sweet. I'm currently playing a lot of Stardew Valley for a very exciting project that is coming up soon that will be announced at some point. So keep an eye out for that. It's very exciting. And I impulse purchased a ukulele this summer, and I'm still working on it. I'm gonna show you this ukulele. It's great.
I'm sorry, they're just like quote, just I impulse bought a ukulele. That is okay, that is a beautiful ukulele.
I think it was like $50, and my spouse was like, that's like a nice date. Like, are you gonna be able to do this for 2 weeks? Because if you can do it for 2 weeks, then it hangs on your wall and it looks nice. And I kept it up for several months.
And
so it's been very fun.
Just for like listener discretion, that's kind of like it's a transparent pink.
Yeah, it's a like pink acrylic ukulele. It's waterproof, apparently.
I'm not sure how I feel about that. You shouldn't be playing ukuleles near water.
Ukuleles are like the thing that you play on the beach.
I don't know. I play a big ukulele called a guitar, so maybe I'm just being a bit more precious about it.
That's fair.
But okay. We can definitely jam sometime. No, I'd be up for that.
That'd be super fun. Yeah. So you play ukulele, play a lot of Stardew. I read a lot of books every once in a while. And then I am bad at sitting still. So I do a lot of like rock climbing, running, strength training, stuff like that. Those are my current hobbies.
I love the way you kind of like dismiss that as just like, yeah, I do all these things. And I'm so interested to learn more about all of them. I'm kind of interested to learn like what is in the retired hobbies section though. What other stuff?
Oh, the retired hobby section. Oh man. So I've done some jewelry making. I did some ice skating for a while. I was in like color guard and dance in high school. That was big. Some of my hobbies go in cycles. So like rock climbing is something that I started doing in middle school, and then I kind of like have on and off done that. I was learning to skateboard until one of my friends broke their collarbone, and I realized that like that was going to be me next. So I'm going to say that was a responsible retiring of a hobby. I rode horses for a long time. That was something that I really enjoyed and missed. I'd probably be doing that if I had access to horses. So some of that is access. Video games are something that I think are another one. Like played a lot of Destiny 2. I'm very, very excited for whenever the next Hades game comes out.
Hades 2 is out soonish, right? As soon? It sometime.
I thought it was going to be like next year sometime.
I know that there is one.
There is one, and I'm very excited. It's going to be great. It's going to be so good. I play a fair amount of board games when I have time. Tabletop games. I just got a new tabletop system that I'm super excited about. That is about, it's created by Snowbright Studios, and I'm blanking on the name, but you are basically playing as like the, your characters are already all dead, and the only way that you level up is through a total party kill. And there's really adorable like ghost baristas. So it's this like fun mix of, yeah, it's this fun mix of like you fight really hard, scary monsters and cute ghosts with coffee.
I mean, it sounds adorable. It sounds mm-hmm. great. Do you have a preferred TTRPG system?
I'm definitely the most comfortable with D&D. It's the thing that I learned first. I don't hold rules for any game super sacred, and so that has allowed me to, because I had a system that I felt really comfortable with, I have been able to like adjust it to the way that works really well for me. I also, I think Coyote and Crow is really cool. I have less familiarity with that. That was a developed by an all indigenous team, which was very, very neat. It takes place in like a post-apocalyptic world where colonialism never happened, which is awesome.
I mean, that doesn't sound post-apocalyptic. It sounds great.
Well, there's like some natural disaster stuff that happened.
Oh.
But it's like we didn't have to deal with. Yeah, we didn't have to deal with, like, it's not like, oh, we now also have to recover not only from this natural disaster, but also from hundreds and hundreds of years of oppression.
Fair. I feel like I've said this on the show before, but I feel like not enough people have tried and enjoyed the 2D20 system used in Star Trek or Dune or Dune, depending on your preferred pronunciation. But like that, like I ran it for people that like hadn't played TTRPGs at all before. You're just rolling, you're adding two numbers together, trying to roll under it. Like you have like, you know, in Dune at least you have like drives, which helps guide the actual role-playing element. It's really simple. Mm-hmm. And also it means you get more nice D20s because they're all you roll.
That's a good selling point. If a system comes with new dice that I have to purchase, I'm on board.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I don't play TTRPGs, but I say I do because I enjoy the collectibles.
That's fair. Also, if you have played enough where you can introduce new people to systems, like I think you've played enough to say that you play.
So I think with like Dune specifically, it was interesting because like half of the guidebook is just lore, and like I love the series, I've read like the whole sets through twice. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I know the universe well enough.
I think that's true with most rule books, especially like maybe not for some of the older like very, very crunchy systems, but I think a lot of the like what's the stuff that you need to actually start playing is actually like relatively short, and then the rest of it is flavor.
Yeah, and I feel like again with maybe like 5e particularly, like I played D&D first, but once you get past that, like all the little numbers are derivatives of the big numbers that you have at the top, that's much easier. I also find it much easier to play with a sort of like guild created large print character sheet, because I just made mm-hmm. the numbers super clear, and I was like, oh yeah, no, I'm only interested in these numbers really.
Yeah, there's some great like dyslexia friendly character sheet. I really like using D&D Beyond because it has all of the information like a click of a button away, and I've heard that it's decently screen reader compatible for anybody who uses a screen reader. It's not perfect, but it's also not awful. Because I think there's so much more, you need more knowledge to set up stuff for like D&D and Pathfinder than you do to actually play.
Mm.
But if you have like a preview character sheet, or you have somebody who can help you with the setup part, then like the actual play part is easier.
I've heard like Pathfinder has like a lot more customization, which makes it look scary, but then once you get past that, it's like a really enriching experience.
My brother really enjoys Pathfinder, and like my brother is also the person who really enjoys like Risk and any kind of super crunchy game. So he likes Pathfinder because it's crunchier.
I like that as a descriptive, like crunchy. Like that's like I really get an essence of what you mean. I'm interested. I've said that a lot, and I really think I should think of other words. You've mentioned mythology a few times. Do you have like a general sort of interest in mythology? Like any favorite mythologies?
So I would say that I have like a fun interest as opposed to like an academic interest in mythology. I would never describe myself as anything resembling even like an armchair expert in any particular mythology, but I was the kid who has read every single like retold mythology and fairy tale story in any book series I could ever possibly get my hands on. I did not have a lot of friends in middle school, so like books were my friends and I read a lot of them. And so Age of Mythology was really fun because it was like the first time I think I got to see like a game in like helped me get to learn. And I'm not speaking for like the accuracy of Age of Mythology 1 back in the early to mid 2000s. But it was cool to get to be like, oh, I could learn stuff about different cultures, about different mythologies, about different stuff through just playing this game. And that like repeated knowledge over and over was something that I thought was just really interesting. I think that stories are really interesting. I think that stories about like gods are really interesting. I was really into reading like fables and stuff as a kid. So
Have you
does that answer your
read
question?
yeah have you read any of sort of like the more recent mythology stuff, like Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology or Stephen Fry's collection on Greek mythology?
I have not read either of those. I really liked a lot of like Donato Napoli's stuff when I was in middle school. I tend to gravitate towards stories that have like as much as I can, I tend to gravitate towards stories that are like written by women or non-binary individuals and have women or non-binary individuals as like main characters. I read a fair amount of sci-fi in like high school and early college, and this is where it really like clicked for me, where my dad would send me some of his favorite books and they were good, but there was a point in which I realized that like some of these stories, there were basically no women in them. And then the women who were in those stories were often like the villain or like their like womanhood or womanness was used almost as just like a foil. And I'm not saying anything about those books in particular. And that just like really bothered me and I didn't like it. Which does not say like I don't read any stories written by men. I absolutely do. It's really hard to do that and to try not to do that in existence world. But yeah, I tend, especially like with grad school, I tend towards the like slightly shorter or very long but very light and fluffy books, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think you make such a great point as well. I think, oh, you know, there's that test that I forget the name of, but like
The
if
Bechdel
two,
test?
that's the one. Yeah. Whereas like if two non-male characters don't have a conversation that isn't about a male character, that's a failure of the test, right?
Yeah, and it's like I think I both really want to remember the name of this book and also don't because I don't want to make people mad on the internet. But there like I'm thinking of this like series and I read like three of them and it was like the third book where I finally was like, "Wait a second." Like the characters in these books that you're supposed to like that are likable, that good things happen to them are all just men. And then like the women are used as like they're often treated as, oh, she's being like super manipulative and like really awful, but like, and she is kind of being manipulative in part because she just wants like access to the same power that the other men in this space have, but she doesn't have access to this, like, can't get access to power through the same avenues. And so she's having to like twist around that. but the book isn't acknowledging those pieces. And so I think like this book probably would have passed the Bechdel test, but it, because this woman also had conversations with, actually, I'm not sure that she had conversations with other women. But if she had, there would have been some conversations like that weren't necessarily about men, but it was still this like this caricature in a way where the male characters felt much more like they were people who had like things that were good about them and things that were bad about them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, there's that like joke that like male writers don't know how to write female characters, right? Like, you know, it's a trope. I think it's really interesting for me as well. I've said interesting again. I'm hyper aware of it now. Because I feel like I didn't read like a lot of books, like just generally. I kind of always defer to other media. And then I picked up a joy of reading, then got weighed down with academia, where like you're basically reading all day and that makes it hard to read for pleasure.
Yeah.
And it is, I think maybe it's kind of because of the fantasy games that I play, but they tend to have, you know, like the Final Fantasy series is about a random collection of people that band together to save the world and kind of like, you know, species, race, sexuality, gender kind of don't really matter because you're just trying to save the world, right? So I kind of always, you know, I feel like I struggle when I find stories like that, that where characters are just not explored thoroughly or one-dimensional.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because it makes it, if part of what I want out of my media is to connect with characters, both like books and video games and movies, if you're just a one-dimensional character, you're harder to connect with. You're harder to find like interesting. It's harder to find nuance in like who you are as a person. I think there's obviously like some exceptions. Like there may be certain villains or something that we have in media that we don't really want people to like feel connected to. If I'm going to put, you know, a Nazi in my game as the villain, I don't want that Nazi to necessarily come off as like redeemable and struggling just from like a, I don't want to support propaganda kind of space. Mm-hmm. But I do think that media is more interesting, and it's been really cool to see. Like, I think I enjoyed the story that I got from The Witcher 3 video game. I feel like I got in some ways like more nuanced and interesting characters than I did from reading some of the books. And so it's been cool to see how with both like technology and investment in games, how rich and exciting storytelling has become. Hades is actually a great example of this. And like, I watched my spouse play Hades, and then Hades was the first roguelike that I played. That is not an area that I am very strong in games. And I just loved the story and the storytelling so much, and the concept so much. And then the gameplay did feel really good once I got used to it, that was very exciting to get to see that.
Yeah, definitely. I just think, yeah, now I'm just thinking about like all like things that I've read and looked at and gone, was this actually as good as like it could have been? Because I think, you know, you make a great point. It's about what are you trying to get out of it, right? And I think so, like with say The Witcher, for example, I think one of the it kind of improves on it, I think, towards some of the latter books, but like predominantly you're getting it through a very limited perspective. Right. And therefore, you can't really go beyond that. Whereas, say, for example, Game of Thrones, that is through several different characters' perspectives, and you kind of get the thing. One of the things I enjoy about that politically is that it's not just here is the good guy, here is the bad guy. It's like everyone is, you kind of get an idea of everyone's moral compass. I'm not saying it's a perfect series or anything like that, but just to.
Yeah, I think. And I have like a whole like series of soapbox I can go off on The Witcher, because I also contribute to that book, the Zeitgeist of The Witcher. But I think The Witcher does an okay job. Like you're right, they're limited perspective. It's not just one perspective. You're not just seeing it through Geralt. You're also getting to see it from, for example, like Ciri has a bunch of like written from about Ciri or from Ciri's perspective. But there is some like interesting world building that can happen when you're shifting back and forth between characters in terms of like being able to build insight around that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely like again, you know, not going to drop massive spoilers, but like that's particularly as the books go on, I feel like that, you know, because Yen gets some chapters and you hear, you know, her perspective, and Milva has some chapters, you know, and you kind of get to see more of these characters, which makes the world feel bigger. So you know, you could maybe say it's an artistic choice, but again, I feel like I definitely agree with you in that we like variety, we like things to be, you know, mixed up, and you know, seeing the world through different perspectives is cool and a good thing, and we like that. Yeah. We should have more of it. To flip this conversation on its head, though, are you reading anything presently? Anything that you'd recommend?
Am I reading anything that I recommend? I'm reading some stuff. I'm reading some stuff. I'm trying to think if there's anything that I'm reading right now that I would recommend on the internet. That's a bar. So here's part of my problem. When I'm just reading for fun, I'm often not reading with a particularly critical eye. And so I will read something and I'll be like, I enjoyed that. And then I have to make a decision about whether or not I paid attention enough to feel good about recommending it.
So if it makes you feel any better, I had the wonderful Anxiety on the show and we were talking about books. And her response was, smut. I've been reading a lot of smut, but also some really like inspiring like self-help books. It's fine to have that, you know, yeah, you enjoy what you enjoy.
I impulse purchased Heartstopper, and then I forgot how quickly graphic novels go, so I like read it in an afternoon at a coffee shop, and that was I know I'm like very behind on that because it's already a Netflix show, but that was just brought me so much joy. It's very cute. It's a very sweet graphic novel story that I really loved. I will say one of my favorite authors of all time that I like go back to whenever I just like need to be happy or like feel okay and not being happy is anything written by Jenny Lawson. So there's actually three of her books are right here. A lot of it is like memoir-y stuff, but it's like a really fun compilation of like broken brain stuff plus texts plus taxidermy plus just fun creativity and funny stories. And that's, I'm not gonna say it's the worst description of her she's probably ever had.
I'm trying to put so many of those people, because that my brain is like, where is that going? What are the things I could learn?
You could learn a lot, probably. I also just really enjoy her. I like really, there's like certain authors where I just really enjoy the way that they talk. So like Jenny Lawson and her writing style, I love like just the way that she constructs sentences makes me very happy. The other person I'm thinking of who does that, oh, I'm blanking on real people names.
Don't worry, I literally just had to look up what book I'm reading because I couldn't remember the name of it, and I'm trying to read it.
It's the writing half of Penny Arcade, who I can't remember his name. Jerry Holgans. Yes. That makes me that like there's often like essays or blog posts that go along with these webcomics, and just the writing style brings me joy.
Mm-hmm. I really like I feel like I could read for days. And I don't know how you feel about playful romance novels.
Yeah, absolutely.
But like I'm currently reading Beach Rivals, which is about an escape to Bali and a bookshop. It's really fun.
That is such a good title. Oh, I do have a book that I can recommend, but I am also going to have to look up the title. I think it's called House Witch.
So this is by Georgie Tilney, which is the pen name for Janina Mathewson, who is an incredible screenwriter from New Zealand originally, but lives in the UK. Done some really cool podcasts, written some great things. Off Things Gonna Stray is her other novel. That's exquisite. That, like, you know, it's about these random people, and then they just wake up one morning and things in their lives are missing. And that includes, like, the whole wall of a house and, like, the ability to speak, I think. Like someone's significant other just disappears, and like they try that and explain this, and they're like, "What do you mean they just disappeared?" And like, "I don't know." And like, yeah, it's shenanigans, but also incredible.
It's a mystery. That's a mystery's work. We don't know.
Would read. Sorry,
It's great.
what book was it that you recommended?
It's called The House Witch. And I had a great time with this one. It's very fun. It's like I really enjoy the stories where you're getting like, yeah, the like big stuff happens where it's like we're fighting monster or whatever. But I also want to know like what your day-to-day life as a house witch, like a witch who has powers connected to like hearth and home and community, what your daily life looks like in a castle where you don't want anyone to know that you have magical powers, so you're trying really hard to hide it. But then anytime somebody like tries to walk into your kitchen, it looks like what is that, like Sleeping Beauty, where like you walk in and you're like, where, why are all the pots floating around? I think those bring me joy. And there's like happy endings.
I was gonna say, do you kind of like enjoy all any sort of like literary fiction that is like based in that reality? They're much more like about those gritty exchanges of real people.
I would say like I read like some, I'd say most of my books probably don't fall in like the gritty category. But it also varies widely. If you like recommend a book and I'm in a good headspace for it, I will probably read it. So especially if it is, I mostly read fiction. I don't read a lot of nonfiction because I read a lot of nonfiction stuff for work.
Yeah,
So like
right.
those.
Yeah, I feel like
Yeah.
if I do read nonfiction, it's maybe like I really enjoy history. History is the topic that like I have no academic interest in, but I love reading about. Historian Greg Jenner, really lovely guy. Dead Famous, 10,000 Years in a Day, where like he goes through the daily life of humanity over,
Oh, that's cool.
like 10,000 years or something. From like the Stone Age to the modern day, and what just a day looks like.
That
That's
is super interesting.
yeah, like that's just a really fun concept for a book, right? Like,
Yeah.
Dead Famous is the history of celebrity from the Bronze Age to the silver screen. Like, it's this
Oh, that
really
is also
cool
cool. That is a
discussion.
wild, yeah. That
Yeah,
is a
like,
wild timeline.
and like how people have been held to select. It's so it can't recommend it enough. Big, big fan.
I will have to check that out. That's awesome.
Yeah, like
I'll
so
do
like
history podcasts, but most like I'll do historical fiction and then I'll do history podcasts.
so again, I feel like podcasts are a great like gateway to that, because you're just like, I mean, History is Sexy is a great one. Greg Jenner does You're Dead to Me as well, which is a history podcast. Like
I really like antisocial studies. I feel like I learned nothing in my like American history high school class, standard American schooling. And so like getting to like this podcast is made by a woman who's like a high school teacher and has a master's degree in history, and it's really interesting and getting to like kind of tie all of those pieces together and also like reflect how like these historical events are showing up or are relevant to events that are happening today.
So I, not entirely, but like a lot of my history knowledge is by proxy, because like one of my friends has done medieval history at like master's level, and so I spent a lot of time with historians back when I could be social and like for more than one night on the bounce, you know what I mean? And like so like I remember having this really cool discussion around how like yeah, so like what we know about wars was written by the people that said they won them, right? But then, like, there are instances
Yeah.
where both sides said they won. So how do we know what happened? And I was like, what on earth?
In college, I took a like history through film class, which then
Ooh.
turned out to just be mostly all the war movies that I had refused to watch with my father. So like that really came back around and bit me in the ass. But it was really interesting getting to kind of like look at the depiction of history and wars and looking at both like, okay, so for example, like this movie was made when the US was like really wanting people to like go into the military, or was gearing up into these tensions. And it was written about this war, this conflict that happened a long time ago, but like the current political climate very much impacted the way in which this story was told at this time. And so that was a super interesting course to get to take.
I mean, history in, I'm going to say England. I don't want to generalize beyond that, because I know it is different in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. But like, they just kind of like, yeah, so we're going to study the British Empire and kind of glaze over the whole, you know, we were actually the bad guys, colonialism kind of business.
Yeah, I think at least my experience in going to public school in Texas in the U.S., there was some similar stuff where like the U.S. was really glad that they could point at Britain as the bad guys and then just like be like, Britain was bad, but we're great. So don't worry about it. Everything's fine.
Yeah, we're not as bad as the other bad guys. They're clearly more evil. Therefore, making you lawfully good.
Basically, that's how that works.
Oh, what a time to be alive! Am I right? okay, so we kind of devolved into chaos here, but I'm here for it.
That's okay.
So sort of this is one of my like favorite questions to ask on the show. But if you had no limitations, you had full access to expertise, resources, time, effort, what's like one blue sky project you would like to do?
The thing that is really running into, there's, can I have two blue sky projects?
I mean, you know, it's your episode. Go for it.
I'll be really fast. Okay. First blue sky project is like a really big, like RCT-esque study of their, yes, of like therapeutic applied role-playing games, because there's some really interesting research and we need a bunch more of it. And I would love to see more of that. Like the have people from like multiple different states or multiple different countries, because it's a blue sky project. That would be incredible. The other blue sky project for me would be related to the work I'm doing now. So we know anecdotally that community health in a game is tied to the bottom line, right? It's tied to how much money that game makes, right? Mm-hmm. That like, ideally, if your community is more healthy and people care more and they want to stay, like your game should make more money, right? But there's not a lot of publicly available information about that. And so it makes it really hard for even people who run the budgets for studios who deeply care about the health of community to prioritize community health and engaging in like pro-social design and support in the budget, because there's never going to be enough money. And so I would love to get to like have a study that was ideally like international and looked at really major indicators of community health, as well as like income from studios and how that impacts people. It's hard to get access to that because reasonably no studio wants to necessarily step forward and be the first one to do it, but and everybody wants to like be better than their competitors, but I think it's something that would be really valuable for like humanity as well as the games industry.
I think that would be really cool to compare, like, especially, oh, it's your blue sky project, but like over time as we're seeing more games be like games as a service, so that having that solid community and player retention, that makes it sound more malicious, but you know, if players keep coming back and your game is a monthly fee and it has season passes and stuff, you'll just make
yeah,
more money.
Right, like it's a thing where and I think it's that space where ideally like I want to focus on sustainable community health, right? Because if you there's an idea like a lot of our stuff has shifted over into this like membership economy, right? Like you don't even get to just like buy Microsoft like Office anymore. You have to buy a subscription.
Yeah.
And that makes companies more money over time. And like I am not gonna say whether or not that's a good thing or a bad thing. But we're seeing the same kind of thing in games. And so if you have something that's a subscription, it's not that I'm trying to get someone to come in and buy something for $20. I'm trying to get someone to come in and continue to engage with my service or my product. And so if engaging with that service or that product is unhealthy or feels really miserable for them or just becomes exhausting, they might give you a bunch of money up front, but they may not continue long term. And if you want to continue making that game or you want to continue making other games, ideally there's this like really nice, I may be too idealistic here, but there's this really nice like middle space, which is like community, like gameplay communities and players are engaging in games in a way that is like rewarding and healthy for them. And it is ideal for studios who are making money and are going to get to continue making money because of this like healthy community.
And there's definitely like, you know, we won't get into it fully, but like there's this like late stage capitalism argument that like, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, getting someone to commit to a subscription, like, was that, that's what occupational psychology was interested in, right? That's where the money was. Whereas like now it's like subscribing to a streaming service for a month costs as much as one ticket for the cinema, right? Or like, yeah, you know, 1 month of Game Pass, play as much as you want of whatever you want. You know, games are getting up to $70 now for one title, mm-hmm, when you can pay for a service and access multiple titles, right? Mm-hmm. So it's definitely, like, there's this weird shift of like, well, oh, well, actually committing to a subscription service is going to be better because I'm not putting down as much out of pocket. And when you're from a lower socioeconomic standpoint and you have less money to start with, that's a more attractive service. Yeah. And it's so insidious. Anywho, let's not, just for the sake of everyone's safety, because this goes out.
I mean, I will also say, like, for games that I feel like the community is solid, I'm excited about what the games are doing, like, I'm more likely to buy a cosmetic or something that I don't need just because I'm excited to get to continue to support this thing that I care about. And so I think absolutely there's some, like, I want to avoid the insidious stuff if I can. But I do think there is a space in which, like, if somebody is doing something that I care about and that I'm enjoying and I'm finding a lot of value in, I want to get to support that in ways that I can.
Yeah. I'll plug that with a real example. Like, I really enjoy Deep Rock Galactic, which is a game that, like, you buy, but is as a service. Mm-hmm. You buy it, you then get the seasons, and then they release cosmetic DLCs. So I always try and pick those up, like, when, yeah, I can, to help the devs. I've already paid
for it.
It's
a great example.
Like, and I love it. So keep making it. Give me more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next sort of official question is there anyone that you would like to signal boost or highlight or shine the spotlight on? To just, you know, uplift and say that they inspire you, that you think that they're awesome?
Oh, man. There are so many people. I didn't prepare for this question.
This question was on the document that I sent you.
I guess
they always try and pull this one. They're like, oh, I wasn't ready.
And I'm seeing it in the document right the second, and I just just pumped back right over that. Honestly, if I had sat with this for longer, I still would not have come up with something better. Honestly, yeah, I do have someone. I mean, I have lots of people, but I will do just one because I keep giving you two answers to things you asked me one for. I actually would love, you've already seen my like show and tell on this, but I will.
Oh, I know what's coming.
Do you know where I'm coming? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I mentioned like ADHD creators that I thought were really phenomenal. One of those is Dani Donovan. She created this amazing thing called the Anti-Planner. Don't be tricked like me and think like, that's a planner, I don't need it, I have those. It's not at all. That's why it says anti. I'm apparently bad at reading. But it's basically just like a really good flow chart for like, if you don't want to do something, you do not want to do something, or you're struggling to get something done, whether you have ADHD or not, oftentimes that struggle is going to be tied into some emotions, right? So, are you feeling stuck, overwhelmed, unmotivated, discouraged, disorganized or discouraged? And then you like flip to that page and then it gives you a more detailed description of what's happening. And then you get to be like, okay, one of these. And then the book is like, here's three things that might help. And those three things that might help are going to look cool.
Okay.
So this is the thing that I am perpetually excited about right now.
So you're giving a shout out to the Anti-Planner?
To Dani Donovan.
Okay.
Huh? I'm giving a like, shout out to the creator of the cool thing, which is Dani.
Okay. I mean, you know, I'm going to clip this bit for like the promotional bit of the episode and just make it look like an ad. And be like, yeah, I'm going to shout out the Anti-Planner. Like,
there you go. I support it.
Creative control. Okay. My sort of last sort of formal question then is, you are going to a biodome of your choice. Because, you know, I wouldn't go to a tropical island. Not my bag. I'd go, mm-hmm, to an autumnal forest. That's me. And you can give me more than one answer for this, because I'm going to ask you for a series of items. But you can take with you one film/DVD box set. If it's sold in one package, you can have it. One album, one book, and one video game. Okay, I'll go through those again,
Okay.
singular. So, a film or TV show slash boxer.
Honestly, I think I would pick Alias.
Okay, nice. Can you tell us what that is?
So it is, I think it was a show in the 2000s. But basically it's this cool woman who's a spy and has to like change what she looks like all the time. And it's just like a, like when it's a show from the early 2000s that brings me joy.
Okay, awesome. One
Yeah.
book.
I actually I'd bring one of these from Jenny Lawson. I probably would pick Let's Pretend This Never Happened.
Okay, excellent book title, by the way. One album. Now, I haven't really touched on music very much.
We haven't really touched on music. I tend to like find music and then just like get stuck on an album for right now. I think the thing that has been on repeat in my car most recently is Stick Season by Noah Kahan, I think is how you
No,
pronounce the
Noah
name.
Kahan. Yeah, I know a few people that are fans of him. Yeah, nice. I do that as well. Like I sort of dissect an album by listening to it constantly. Funny story about an
You just have
album.
to stop before you start hating it.
Yes, I'll tell you a funny story about an album when we get off air. And then one video game, and I'm gonna veto and say you can't take Stardew Valley for that thing that
I
you're
would
not
take
gonna announce.
Hades.
Okay, Hades.
I'd take
All
Hades.
right.
Yeah.
Okay, that, I feel like that choice is well defended. And then the last thing is I like to turn the tables and say, would you like to ask me anything? I've had the biodome
Yeah.
question. Please don't ask about my PhD.
What is something in the world that you're excited about right now? Like it could be a piece of media, it could be a project that you or somebody else is working on, it could be a movie that you discovered the other week.
Okay, so I'm gonna Uno reverse you. I'm gonna give you two answers. One, because I'm not sure how much I
Okay.
can say about it, but I'm currently working on a book chapter with Dr. Kelly Dunlap, which has brought me immense joy, to work with someone I see as a heroine, and a legend in the space.
That's
That's about
awesome.
griefing games. So that's just been really cool. Something really, really, fundamental. And I did a panel on that at PAX, and that kind of things are kind
It's a
of
great panel.
thank you. Tying all that together, but I don't know how much I can say about that. The other one is because it was properly, announced with a release date yesterday in terms of when we're recording, because Jeremy burying me, baby, it makes no sense. Final Fantasy VII Rebirth coming out February 29th, 2024. I am gonna be doing nothing else for a week solid. I'm gonna finally have to capitulate and buy a PS5. You know what I mean? I'm legitimately just hyped. It just looks like it's gonna be a journey. Like the fact that we are in 2023 and I can be sat here talking to you about Final Fantasy VII and not have any idea what's gonna happen, that this is brand new content, is freaking wild, and I love that. Like even if it doesn't meet my expectations, I'm just excited that it's new.
That's fair. I'm shocked that it has taken this long in the interview for that to come up.
I try and be a professional host. I try not to timestamp the episodes too hard,
That's fair.
Okay. That was a great question, by the way. It was very fun. And
Thanks.
in this golden age of social media, and all the links will be attached to this episode wherever you found it, but where can people find you? Where can people follow your adventures and find where to buy your book and all those type of whimsical things?
Yeah, so I have a website. It's elizabethkilmer.com.
Love it.
That has links to stuff about me. I currently am still on the bird app. I think that is right here. I try and keep my name consistent across socials. And you can obviously find me over at Take This or at Save Point Behavioral Health.
Okay, excellent. And out of interest, because I'm a fan of Take This. Are you not in the Take This Discord, the best place on the internet?
I am in the Take This Discord technically. I'm not super active in the Take This Discord because I can only have a couple of Discords that I'm currently maxed out on my number of Discords that I can pay attention to.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
Just purely, I'm interested in what that number is, because I have
It's
way
one
too
and a
many.
half.
One and a half, I
It's
get
one
you.
and a half. Like I'm in other Discords, I'm just like not active in them.
Oh,
I don't understand.
I'm in way more than I can actually facilitate in. And like, I have one that's my own. That kind of like, you know. Yeah.
So one and a half.
Anywho,
the answer.
Use social media responsibly, listeners and viewers.
Please do.
Okay, all that remains me to do is just say thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great chat. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. As always, please like, subscribe, review the podcast wherever you listen to it. That's a big thing that costs you nothing. Follow my wonderful guest. Keep up with the rest of the show because, you know, I keep churning these out. Churning makes it sound like it's a chore, but really it's not. It's just chatting with great people. But otherwise, take it easy. As we always say on this show, look after your mind, body, and soul. And Dr. Elizabeth Kilmer, I have been psyched to be with you. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
There we go. And well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. If you did, do please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps. Otherwise, check out the description of the episode for the links for the guest, but also to keep up with information about the show and myself. I really hope you enjoyed this listen. Until next time, take it easy, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I'll see you again for another episode very, very soon. Bye-bye.